for the first time. Why did she go?
I don't know.
Horace said angrily, You watch it, Trask. You're playing pretty close to the edge, and I don't like what I'm thinking. You must know why she went away.
I don't know why she went.
Was she sick? Did she act strange?
No.
Horace turned. Ching Chong, do you know anything about this?
I go King City Saturday. Come back maybe 12 night. Find Missy Trask on floor.
So you weren't here when it happened?
No, ma'am.
All right, Trask. I'll have to get back to you. Open up that shade a little, Ching Chong, so I can see. There, that's better. Now I'm going to do it your way first until I can't anymore. Your wife went away. Did she shoot you?
It was an accident.
All right, an accident, but was the gun in her hand?
It was an accident.
You don't make it very easy. But let's say she went away and we have to find her, see? Like a kid's game. You're making it that way. How long have you been married?
Nearly a year.
What was your name before you married her? There was a long pause, and then Adam said softly,
I won't tell. I promised.
Now you watch it. Where does she come from?
I don't know.
Mr. Trask, you're talking yourself right into the county jail. Let's have a description. How tall was she? Adam's eyes gleamed.
Not tall. Little and delicate.
That's just fine. What color hair? Eyes?
She was beautiful.
Was?
Is.
Any scars?
Oh, God, no. Yes. A scar on her forehead.
You don't know her name, where she came from, where she went, and you can't describe her. And you think I'm a fool.
Adam said, She had a secret. I promised I wouldn't ask her. She was afraid for someone.
And without warning, Adam began to cry. His whole body shook, and his breath made little high sounds. It was hopeless crying. Horace felt misery rising in him. Come on in the other room, Julius, he said, and led the way into the living room. All right, Julius, tell me what you think. Is he crazy?
I don't know.
Did he kill her?
That's what jumped into my mind.
Mine too, said Horace. My God. He hurried into the bedroom and came back with the pistol and the shells. I forgot them, he apologized. I won't last long on this job. Julius asked, What are you going to do? Well, I think it's beyond me. I told you I wouldn't put you on the payroll, but hold up your right hand.
I don't want to get sworn in, Horace. I want to go to Salinas.
You don't have any choice, Julius. I'll have to arrest you if you don't get your goddamn hand up. Julius reluctantly put up his hand and disgustedly repeated the oath.
And that's what I get for keeping you company, he said. My father will skin me alive.
All right, what do we do now? Horace said, I'm going to run to Papa. I need the sheriff. I'd take Trask in, but I don't want to move him. You've got to stay, Julius, I'm sorry. Have you got a gun?
Hell no.
Well, take this one and take my star. He unpinned it from his shirt and held it out.
How long do you think you'll be gone?
Not any longer than I can help. Did you ever see Mrs. Trask, Julius?
No, I didn't.
Neither did I. And I've got to tell the sheriff that Trask doesn't know her name or anything. And she's not very big, and she is beautiful. That's one hell of a description. I think I'll resign before I tell the sheriff, because he's sure as hell going to fire me afterward. Do you think he killed her?
How the hell do I know?
Don't get mad. Julius picked up the gun and put the cartridges back in the cylinder and balanced it in his hand.
You want an idea, Horace?
Don't I look like I need one?
Well, Sam Hamilton knew her. He took the babies, Rabbit says. And Mrs. Hamilton took care of her. Why don't you ride out there on your way and find out what she really looked like?
I think maybe you better keep that star, said Horace. That's good. I'll get going.
You want me to look around?
I want you just to see that he doesn't get away or hurt himself. Understand? Take care of yourself.
About midnight, Horace got on a freight train in King City. He sat up in the cab with the engineer, and he was in Salinas the first thing in the morning. Salinas was the county seat, and it was a fast-growing town. Its population was due to cross the 2,000 mark any time. It was the biggest town between San Jose and San Luis Obispo, and everyone felt that a brilliant future was in store for it. Horace walked up from the Southern Pacific Depot and stopped in the chop house for breakfast. He didn't want to get the sheriff out so early and rouse ill will when it wasn't necessary. In the chop house, he ran into young Will Hamilton, looking pretty prosperous in a salt-and-pepper business suit. Horace sat down at the table with him.
How are you, Will?
Oh, pretty good.
Up here on business?
Well, yes, I do have a little deal on.
You might let me in on something sometime.
Horace felt strange talking like this to such a young man, but Will Hamilton had an aura of success about him. Everybody knew he was going to be a very influential man in the county. Some people exude their futures, good or bad.
I'll do that, Horace. I thought the ranch took all your time.
I could be persuaded to rent it if anything turned up.
Will leaned over the table.
You know, Horace, our part of the county has been pretty much left out. Did you ever think of running for office?
What do you mean?
Well, you're a deputy. Did you ever think of running for sheriff?
Why, no, I didn't.
Well, you think about it. Just keep it under your hat. I'll look you up in a couple of weeks and we'll talk about it. But keep it under your hat.
I'll certainly do that, Will.
But we've got an awfully good sheriff. I know, that's got nothing to do with it. King City hasn't got a single county officer, you see?
I see. I'll think about it.
Oh, by the way, I stopped by and saw your father and mother yesterday. Will's face lighted up.
You did? How were they?
Just fine. You know, your father is a real comical genius.
Will chuckled.
He made us laugh all the time we were growing up.
But he's a smart man, too, Will. He showed me a new kind of windmill he's invented. Goddamnedest thing you ever saw.
Oh, Lord, said Will. Here comes the patent attorneys again.
But this is good, said Horace.
They're all good. And the only people who make any money are the patent lawyers. Drives my mother crazy.
I guess you got a point there.
Will said, the only way to make any money is to sell something somebody else makes.
You got a point there, Will. But this is the goddamnedest windmill you ever saw.
He took you in, did he, Horace?
I guess he did. But you wouldn't want him to change, would you?
Oh, Lord, no, said Will. You think about what I said.
All right.
And keep it under your hat, said Will.
The sheriff's job was not an easy one. And that county which, out of the grab bag of popular elections, pulled a good sheriff was lucky. It was a complicated position. The obvious duties of the sheriff, enforcing the law and keeping the peace, were far from the most important ones. It was true that the sheriff represented armed force in the county, but in a community seething with individuals, a harsh or stupid sheriff didn't last long. There were water rights, boundary disputes, estray arguments, domestic relations, paternity matters, all to be settled without force of arms. Only when everything else failed did a good sheriff make an arrest. The best sheriff was not the best fighter, but the best diplomat. And Monterey County had a good one. He had a brilliant gift for minding his own business. Horace went into the sheriff's office in the old county jail about 10 minutes after 9. The sheriff shook hands and discussed the weather and the crops until Horace was ready to get down to business.
Well, sir, Horace said finally, I had to come up and get your advice. And he told his story in great detail. What everybody had said, and how they looked, and what time it was. Everything. After a few moments, the sheriff closed his eyes and laced his fingers together. He punctuated the account occasionally by opening his eyes, but he made no comment. Well, there I was on a limb, Horace said. I couldn't find out what happened. I couldn't even find out what the woman looked like. It was Julius U. Scotty got the idea I should go see Sam Hamilton. The sheriff stirred, crossed his legs, and inspected the job.
You think he killed her?
Well, I did, but Mr. Hamilton kind of talked me out of it. He says Trask hasn't got it in him to kill anybody.
Everybody's got it in him, the sheriff said. You just find his trigger and anybody will go off.
Mr. Hamilton told me some funny things about her. You know, when he was taking her babies, she bit him on the hand. You ought to see that hand like a wolf got him.
Did Sam give you a description?
He did, and his wife did. Horace took a piece of paper from his pocket and read a detailed description of Kathy. Between the two of them, the Hamiltons knew pretty much everything physical there was to know about Kathy. When Horace finished, the sheriff sighed.
They both agreed about the scar?
Yes, they did. And both of them remarked about how sometimes it was darker than other times. The sheriff closed his eyes again and leaned back in his chair. Suddenly, he straightened up, opened a drawer of his roll-top desk, and took out a pint of whiskey.
Have a drink, he said. Don't mind if I do. Here's looking at you.
Horace wiped his mouth and handed back the pint.
Got any ideas? He asked.
The sheriff took three big swallows of whiskey, corked the pint, and put it back in the drawer before he replied.
We've got a pretty well-run county, he said. I get along with the constables, give them a hand when they need it, and they help me out when I need it. You take a town growing like Salinas, and strangers in and out all the time. We could have trouble if we didn't watch it pretty close. My office gets along fine with the local people.
He looked Horace in the eye.
And don't get restless. I'm not making a speech. I just want to tell you how it is. We don't drive people. We've got to live with them.
Did I do something wrong?
No, you didn't, Horace. You did just right. If you hadn't come to town, or if you had brought Mr. Trask in, we'd be in one hell of a mess. Now hold on. I'm going to tell you.
I'm listening, said Horace.
Over across the tracks, down by Chinatown, there's a row of whorehouses.
I know that.
Everybody knows it. If we close them up, they'd just move. The people want those houses. We keep an eye on them so not much bad happens. And the people that run those houses keep in touch with us. I picked up some wanted men from tips I got down there.
Horace said, Julius told me,
now wait a minute, let me get all this said, so we won't have to go back over it. About 3 months ago, a fine-looking woman came in to see me. She wanted to open a house here, and wanted to do it right. Came from Sacramento, ran a place there. She had letters from some pretty important people. Straight record, never had any trouble. A pretty damn good citizen.
Julius told me, name of Faye.
That's right. Well, she opened a nice place. Quiet, well-run. It was about time old Jenny and the nigger had some competition. They were mad as hell about it, but I told them just what I told you. It's about time they had some competition.
There's a piano player.
Yes, there is. Good one, too. Blind fella.
Say, are you going to let me tell this?
I'm sorry, said Horace. That's all right. I know I'm slow, but I'm thorough. Anyways, Faye turned out to be just what she looks like, a good, solid citizen. Now, there's one thing a good, quiet whorehouse is more scared of than anything else. Take a flighty, randy girl, runs off from home, and goes in a house. Her old man finds her, and he begins to shovel up hell. Then the churches get into it, and the women, and pretty soon that whorehouse has got a bad name, and we've got to close it up. You understand?
Yeah,
Horace said softly. Now, don't get ahead of me. I hate to tell you something you already thought out. Faye sent me a note Sunday night. She's got a girl, and she can't make much out of her. And what puzzles Faye is that this kid looks like a runaway girl, except she's a goddamn good whore. She knows all the answers and all the tricks. I went down and looked her over. She told me the usual bull, but I can't find a thing wrong with her. She's of age, and nobody's made a complaint. He spread his hands. Well, there it is. What do we do about it? You're pretty sure it's Mrs. Trask? The sheriff said. Wide-set eyes, yellow hair, and a scar on her forehead. And she came in Sunday afternoon. Adam's weeping face was in Horace's mind. God almighty, Sheriff. You got to get somebody else to tell him. I'll quit before I do. The sheriff gazed into space. You say he didn't even know her name, where she came from. She really bullshitted him, didn't she? The poor bastard, Horace said. The poor bastard is in love with her. No, by God, somebody else has got to tell him. I won't. The sheriff stood up. Let's go down to the chop house and get a cup of coffee. They walked along the street in silence for a while. Horace, the sheriff said, if I told some of the things I know, this whole goddamn county would go up in smoke. I guess that's right. You said she had twins? Yeah, twin boys. You listen to me, Horace. There's only three people in the world that knows. Her and you and me. I'm going to warn her that if she ever tells, I'll brush her ass out of this county so fast it'll burn. And Horace, if you should ever get an itchy tongue, before you tell anybody, even your wife, why you think about those little boys finding out their mother is a whore. Adam sat in his chair under the big oak tree. His left arm was expertly bandaged against his side so that he couldn't move his shoulder. Lee came out carrying the laundry basket. He set it on the ground beside Adam and went back inside. The twins were awake, and they both looked blindly and earnestly up at the wind-moved leaves of the oak tree. A dry oak leaf came whirling down and landed in the basket. Adam leaned over and picked it out. He didn't hear Samuel's horse until it was almost upon him, but Lee had seen it coming. He brought a chair out and led Doxology away toward the shed. Samuel sat down quietly, and he didn't trouble Adam by looking at him too much, and he didn't trouble him by not looking at him. The wind freshened in the treetops, and a fringe of it ruffled Samuel's hair. I thought I'd better get back to the wells, Samuel said softly. Adam's voice had gone rusty from lack of use. No, he said. I don't want any wells. I'll pay for the work you did. Samuel leaned over the basket and put his finger against the small palm of one of the twins, and the fingers closed and held on. I guess the last bad habit a man will give up is advising. I don't want advice. Nobody does. It's a giver's present. Go through the motions, Adam. What motions? Act out being alive, like a play. And after a while, a long while, it'll be true. Why should I? Adam asked. Samuel was looking at the twins. You're going to pass something down, no matter what you do, or if you do nothing. Even if you let yourself go fallow, the weeds will grow, and the brambles. Something will grow. Adam didn't answer, and Samuel stood up. I'll be back, he said. I'll be back again and again. Go through the motions, Adam. In the back of the shed, Lee held Doxology while Sam mounted. There goes your bookstore, Lee, he said. Oh, well, said the Chinese. Maybe I didn't want it much anyway.
This ends Disc 8. East of Eden, Disc 9.
Chapter 19. A new country seems to follow a pattern. First come the openers, strong and brave and rather childlike. They can take care of themselves in a wilderness, but they are naive and helpless against men. And perhaps that is why they went out in the first place. When the rough edges are worn off the new land, businessmen and lawyers come in to help with the development, to solve problems of ownership, usually by removing the temptations to themselves. And finally comes culture, which is entertainment, relaxation, transport out of the pain of living. And culture can be on any level, and is. The church and the whorehouse arrived in the far west simultaneously, and each would have been horrified to think it was a different facet of the same thing. But surely they were both intended to accomplish the same thing. The singing, the devotion, the poetry of the churches took a man out of his bleakness for a time, and so did the brothels. The sectarian churches came in swinging, cocky and loud and confident. Ignoring the laws of debt and repayment, they built churches which couldn't be paid for in 100 years. The sects fought evil, true enough, but they also fought each other with a fine lustiness. They fought at the turn of a doctrine. Each happily believed all the others were bound for hell in a basket, and each, for all its bumptiousness, brought with it the same thing, the scripture on which our ethics, our art and poetry, and our relationships are built. It took a smart man to know where the differences lay between the sects, but anyone could see what they had in common. And they brought music, maybe not the best, but the form and sense of it. And they brought conscience, or rather nudged the dozing conscience. They weren't pure, but they had a potential of purity, like a soiled white shirt. And any man could make something pretty fine of it within himself. True enough, the Reverend Billing, when they caught up with him, turned out to be a thief, an adulterer, a libertine, and a zoophilist. But that didn't change the fact that he had communicated some good things to a great number of receptive people. Billing went to jail, but no one ever arrested the good things he had released. And it doesn't matter much that his motive was impure. He used good material, and some of it stuck. I use Billing only as an outrageous example. The honest preachers had energy and go. They fought the devil, no holds barred, boots and eye gouging permitted. You might get the idea that they howled truth and beauty the way a seal bites out the national anthem on a row of circus horns. But some of the truth and beauty remained, and the anthem was recognizable. The sects did more than this, though. They built the structure of social life in the Salinas Valley. The church supper is the grandfather of the country club, just as the Thursday poetry reading in the basement under the vestry sired the little theater. While the churches, bringing the sweet smell of piety for the soul, came in prancing and farting like brewery horses in Bock beer time, the sister evangelism, with release and joy for the body, crept in silently and grayly, with its head bowed and its face covered. You may have seen the spangled palaces of sin and fancy dancing in the false west of the movies, and maybe some of them existed, but not in the Salinas Valley. The brothels were quiet, orderly, and circumspect. Indeed, if after hearing the ecstatic shrieks of climactic conversion against the thumping beat of the melodeon, you had stood under the window of a whorehouse and listened to the low, decorous voices, you would have been likely to confuse the identities of the two ministries. The brothel was accepted while it wasn't admitted. I will tell you about the solemn courts of love in Salinas. They were about the same in other towns, but the Salinas Row has a pertinence to this telling. You walked west on Main Street until it bent. That's where Castroville Street crossed Main. Castroville Street is now called Market Street, God knows why. Streets used to be named for the place they aimed at. Thus, Castroville Street, if you followed it 9 miles, brought you to Castroville. Alisal Street to Alisal, and so forth. Anyway, when you came to Castroville Street, you turned right. Two blocks down, the Southern Pacific tracks cut diagonally across the street on their way south, and a street crossed Castroville Street from east to west, and for the life of me, I cannot remember the name of that street. If you turned left on that street and crossed the tracks, you were in Chinatown. If you turned right, you were on the row. It was a black, doby street, deep, shining mud in winter and hard as rutted iron in summer. In the spring, the tall grass grew along its sides, wild oats and mallow weeds and yellow mustard mixed in. In the early morning, the sparrows shrieked over the horse manure in the street. Do you remember hearing that, old man? And do you remember how an easterly breeze brought odors in from Chinatown? Roasting pork and punk and black tobacco and yen shi. And do you remember the deep, blatting stroke of the great gong in the Joss House, and how its tone hung in the air so long? Remember, too, the little houses, unpainted, unrepaired? They seemed very small, and they tried to efface themselves in outside neglect, and the wild, overgrown front yards tried to hide them from the street. Remember how the shades were always drawn with little lines of yellow light around their edges? You could only hear a murmur from within. Then the front door would open to admit a country boy, and you'd hear laughter and perhaps the soft, sentimental tone of an open-faced piano with a piece of toilet chain across the strings. And then the door would close it off again. Then you might hear horses' hoofs on the dirt street, and Pet Boleyn would drive his hack up in front, and maybe four or five portly men would get out. Great men, rich or official, bankers maybe, or the courthouse gang. And Pet would drive around the corner and settle down in his hack to wait for them. Big cats would ripple across the street to disappear in the tall grass. And then, remember, the train whistle and the boring light and a freight from King City would go stomping across Castroville Street and into Salinas, and you could hear it sighing at the station. Remember? Every town has its celebrated madams, eternal women to be sentimentalized down the years. There is something very attractive to men about a madam. She combines the brains of a businessman, the toughness of a prize fighter, the warmth of a companion, the humor of a tragedian. Myths collect around her, and, oddly enough, not voluptuous myths. The stories remembered and repeated about a madam cover every field but the bedroom. Remembering her, old customers picture her as philanthropist, medical authority, bouncer, and poetess of the bodily emotions without being involved with them. For a number of years, Salinas had sheltered two of these treasures. Jenny, sometimes called Fartin' Jenny, and the nigger, who owned and operated the Long Green. Jenny was a good companion, a keeper of secrets, a giver of secret loans. There is a whole literature of stories about Jenny and Salinas. The nigger was a handsome, austere woman with snow-white hair and a dark and awful dignity. Her brown eyes, brooding deep in her skull, looked out on an ugly world with philosophic sorrow. She conducted her house like a cathedral dedicated to a sad but erect Priapus. If you wanted a good laugh and a poke in the ribs, you went to Jenny's and got your money's worth. But if the sweet world sadness, close to tears, crept out of your immutable loneliness, the Long Green was your place. When you came out of there, you felt that something pretty stern and important had happened. It was no jump in the hay. The dark, beautiful eyes of the nigger stayed with you for days. When Faye came down from Sacramento and opened her house, there was a flurry of animosity from the two incumbents. They got together to drive Faye out, but they discovered she wasn't in competition. Faye was a motherly type, big-breasted, big-hipped, and warm. She was a bosom to cry on, a soother and a stroker. The iron sex of the nigger and the tavern bacchanalianism of Jenny had their devotees, and they were not lost to Faye. Her house became the refuge of young men puling in puberty, mourning over lost virtue and aching to lose some more. Fay was the reassurer of misbegotten husbands. Her house took up the slack for frigid wives. It was the cinnamon-scented kitchen of one's grandmother. If any sexual thing happened to you at Fay's, you felt it was an accident, but forgivable. Her house led the youths of Salinas into the thorny path of sex in the pinkest, smoothest way. Fay was a nice woman, not very bright, highly moral, and easily shocked. People trusted her, and she trusted everyone. No one could want to hurt Fay once he knew her. She was no competition to the others. She was a third phase. Just as in a store or on a ranch, the employees are images of the boss, so in a whorehouse, the girls are very like the madam. Partly because she hires that kind, and partly because a good madam imprints her personality on the business. You could stay a very long time at Fay's before you would hear an ugly or suggestive word spoken. The wanderings to the bedrooms, the payments, were so soft and casual they seemed incidental. All in all, she ran a hell of a fine house, as the constable and the sheriff knew. Fay contributed heavily to every charity. Having a revulsion against disease, she paid for regular inspections of her girls. You had less chance of contracting a difficulty at Fay's than with your Sunday school teacher. Fay soon became a solid and desirable citizen of the growing town of Salinas. The girl, Kate, puzzled Fay. She was so young and pretty, so ladylike, so well-educated. Fay took her in to her own inviolate bedroom and questioned her far more than she would if Kate had been another kind of girl. There were always women knocking on the door of a whorehouse, and Fay recognized most of them instantly. She could tick them off. Lazy, vengeful, lustful, unsatisfied, greedy, ambitious. Kate didn't fall into any of these classes. "I hope you don't mind my asking you all these questions," she said. "It just seems so strange that you should come here. Why, you could get a husband and a Surrey and a corner house in town with no trouble at all. No trouble at all." And Fay rolled her wedding band around and around in her fat little finger. Kate smiled shyly. "It's so hard to explain. I hope you won't insist on knowing. The happiness of someone very near and dear to me is involved. Please don't ask me." Fay nodded solemnly. "I've known things like that. I had one girl who was supporting her baby, and no one knew for a long, long time. That girl has a fine house and a husband in... There, I nearly told you where. I'd cut my tongue out before I'd tell. Do you have a baby, dear?" Kate looked down to try to conceal the shine of tears in her eyes. When she could control her throat, she whispered, "I'm sorry. I can't talk about it." "That's all right. That's all right. You just take your time." Fay wasn't bright, but she was far from stupid. She went to the sheriff and got herself cleared. There was no sense in taking chances. She knew something was wrong about Kate, but if it didn't harm the house, it really wasn't Fay's business. Kate might have been a chiseler, but she wasn't. She went to work right away. And when customers come back again and again and ask for a girl by name, you know you've got something. A pretty face won't do that. It was quite apparent to Fay that Kate wasn't learning a new trade. There are two things it's good to know about a new girl. First, will she work? And second, will she get along with the other girls? There is nothing will upset a house like an ill-tempered girl. Fay didn't have long to wonder about the second question. Kate put herself out to be pleasant. She helped the other girls keep their rooms clean. She served them when they were sick, listened to their troubles, answered them in matters of love, and as soon as she had some, loaned them money. You couldn't want a better girl. She became best friend to everyone in the house. There was no trouble Kate would not take, no drudgery she was afraid of, and in addition, she brought business. She soon had her own group of regular customers. Kate was thoughtful, too. She remembered birthdays and always had a present and a cake with candles. Fay realized she had a treasure.
People who don't know think it is easy to be a madam. Just sit in a big chair and drink beer and take half the money the girls make, they think. But it's not like that at all. You have to feed the girls. That's groceries and a cook. Your laundry problem is quite a bit more complicated than that of a hotel. You have to keep the girls well and as happy as possible, and some of them can get pretty ornery. You have to keep suicide at an absolute minimum, and whores, particularly the ones getting along in years, are flighty with a razor, and that gets your house a bad name. It isn't so easy, and if you have waste, too, you can lose money. When Kate offered to help with the marketing and planning of meals, Faye was pleased, although she didn't know when the girl found time. Well, not only did the food improve, but the grocery bills came down one-third the first month Kate took over. And the laundry. Faye didn't know what Kate said to the man, but that bill suddenly dropped 25%. Faye didn't see how she ever got along without Kate. In the late afternoon before business, they sat together in Faye's room and drank tea. It was much nicer since Kate had painted the woodwork and put up lace curtains. The girls began to realize that there were two bosses, not one, and they were glad, because Kate was very easy to get along with. She made them turn more tricks, but she wasn't mean about it. They'd as likely as not have a big laugh over it. By the time a year had passed, Faye and Kate were like mother and daughter. And the girl said, "You watch, she'll own this house someday." Kate's hands were always busy, mostly at drawn work on the sheerest of lawn handkerchiefs. She could make beautiful initials. Nearly all the girls carried and treasured their handkerchiefs. Gradually, a perfectly natural thing happened. Faye, the essence of motherness, began to think of Kate as her daughter. She felt this in her breast and in her emotions, and her natural morality took hold. She did not want her daughter to be a whore. It was a perfectly reasonable sequence. Faye thought hard how she was going to bring up the subject. It was a problem. It was Faye's nature to approach any subject sideways. She couldn't say, "I want you to give up whoring." She said, "If it is a secret, don't answer. But I've always meant to ask you. What did the sheriff say to you? Good Lord, is it a year ago? How the time goes. Quicker as you get older, I think. He was nearly an hour with you. He didn't... But of course not. He's a family man. He goes to Jenny's. But I don't want to pry into your affairs." "There's no secret at all about it," said Kate. "I would have told you. He told me I should go home. He was very nice about it. When I explained that I couldn't, he was very nice and understanding."
"Did you tell him why?"
Faye asked jealously.
"Of course not. Do you think I would tell him when I won't tell you? Don't be silly, darling. You're such a funny little girl."
Faye smiled and snuggled contentedly down in her chair. Kate's face was in repose, but she was remembering every word of that interview. As a matter of fact, she rather liked the sheriff. He was direct. He had closed the door of her room, glanced around with the quick recording eye of a good policeman. No photographs, none of the personal articles which identify, nothing but clothes and shoes. He sat down on her little cane rocking chair, and his buttocks hung over on each side. His fingers got together in conference, talking to one another like ants. He spoke in an unemotional tone, almost as though he weren't much interested in what he was saying. Maybe that was what impressed her. At first, she put on her slightly stupid, demure look. But after a few of his words, she gave that up and bored into him with her eyes, trying to read his thoughts. He neither looked in her eyes nor avoided them, but she was aware that he was inspecting her as she inspected him. She felt his glance go over the scar on her forehead almost as though he had touched it. "I don't want to make a record," he said quietly. "I've held office a long time. About one more term will be enough."
You know, young woman, if this were 15 years back, I'd do some checking, and I guess I'd find something pretty nasty. He waited for some reaction from her, but she didn't protest. He nodded his head slowly. I don't want to know, he said. I want peace in this county, and I mean all kinds of peace, and that means people getting to sleep at night. Now, I haven't met your husband, he said, and she knew he noticed the slight movement of her tightening muscles. I hear he's a very nice man. I also hear that he's pretty hard hit. He looked into her eyes for a moment. Don't you want to know how bad you shot him?
Yes, she said.
Well, he's going to get well. Smashed his shoulder, but he's going to get well. That chink has taken pretty good care of him. Of course, I don't think he'll lift anything with his left arm for quite a spell. A .44 tears hell out of a man. If the chink hadn't come back, he'd have bled to death, and you'd be staying with me in the jail. Kate was holding her breath, listening for any hint of what was coming, and not hearing any hints.
I'm sorry, she said quietly.
The sheriff's eyes became alert. Now, that's the first time you've made a mistake, he said. You're not sorry. I knew somebody like you once. Hung him 12 years ago in front of the county jail. We used to do that here. The little room with its dark mahogany bed, its marble-top washstand with bowl and pitcher, and a door for the pot, its wallpaper endlessly repeating little roses, little roses. The little room was silent, the sound sucked out of it. The sheriff was staring at a picture of three cherubim, just heads, curly-haired, limpid-eyed, with wings about the size of pigeons' wings, growing out of where their necks would be. He frowned. That's a funny picture for a whorehouse, he said.
It was here, said Kate. Apparently the preliminaries were over now.
The sheriff straightened up, undid his fingers, and held the arms of his chair. Even his buttocks pulled in a little. You left a couple of babies, he said. Little boys. Now you calm down. I'm not going to try to get you to go back. I guess I'd do quite a bit to keep you from going back. I think I know you. I could just run you over the county line and have the next sheriff run you, and that could keep up till you landed splash in the Atlantic Ocean. But I don't want to do that. I don't care how you live, as long as you don't give me any trouble. A whore is a whore.
Kate asked evenly, What is it you do want?
That's more like it, the sheriff said. Here's what I want. I noticed you changed your name. I want you to keep your new name. I guess you made up some place you came from. Well, that's where you came from. And your reason, that's when you're maybe drunk. You keep your reason about 2,000 miles away from King City.
She was smiling a little, and not a forced smile. She was beginning to trust this man. And to like him.
One thing I thought of, he said. Do you know many people around King City?
No.
I heard about the knitting needle, he said casually. Well, it could happen that somebody you knew might come in here. That your real hair color?
Yes.
Dye it black for a while. Lots of people look like somebody else.
How about this?
She touched her scar with a slender finger. Well, that's just a... What is that word? What is that goddamn word I had of this morning?
Coincidence?
That's it. Coincidence.
He seemed to be finished. He got out tobacco and papers and rolled a clumsy, lumpy cigarette. He broke out a sulfur match and struck it on the block and held it away until its acrid blue flame turned yellow. His cigarette burned crookedly up the side. Kate said, Isn't there a threat? I mean, what you'll do if I...
No, there isn't. I guess I could think up something pretty ornery, though, if it came to that. No, I don't want you, what you are, what you do, or what you say, to hurt Mr. Trask or his boys. You figure you died, and now you're somebody else, and we'll get along fine. He stood up and went to the door, then turned. I've got a boy. He'll be 20 this year. Big, nice-looking fellow with a broken nose. Everybody likes him. I don't want him in here. I'll tell Faye, too. Let him go to Jenny's. If he comes in, you tell him to go to Jenny's. He closed the door behind him. Kate smiled down at her fingers. Faye twisted around in her chair to reach a piece of brown panocha studded with walnuts. When she spoke, it was around a mouthful of candy. Kate wondered uneasily whether she could read minds, for Faye said, "I still don't like it as well. I said it then, and I say it again. I like your hair blonde better. I don't know what got into you to change it. You got a fair complexion." Kate caught a single thread of hair with fingernails of thumb and forefinger and gently drew it out. She was very clever. She told the best lie of all, the truth. "I didn't want to tell you," she said. "I was afraid I might be recognized, and that would hurt someone." Faye got up out of her chair and went to Kate and kissed her. "What a good child it is," she said. "What a thoughtful dear." Kate said, "Let's have some tea. I'll bring it in." She went out of the room, and in the hall, on the way to the kitchen, she rubbed the kiss from her cheek with her fingertips. Back in her chair, Faye picked out a piece of pinocchio with a whole walnut showing through. She put it in her mouth and bit into a piece of walnut shell. The sharp, pointed fragment hit a hollow tooth and whanged into the nerve. Blue lights of pain flashed through her. Her forehead became wet. When Kate came back with teapot and cups on a tray, Faye was clawing at her mouth with a crooked finger and whimpering in agony. "What is it?" Kate cried. "Tooth, nutshell. Here, let me see. Open and point." Kate looked into the open mouth, then went to the nut bowl on the fringe table for a nutpick. In a fraction of a second, she had dug out the shell and held it in the palm of her hand. "There it is." The nerve stopped shrieking and the pain dropped to an ache. "Only that big? It felt like a house." "Look, dear," said Faye, "open that second drawer where my medicine is. Bring the paregoric and a piece of cotton. Will you help me pack this tooth?" Kate brought the bottle and pushed a little ball of saturated cotton into the tooth with the point of the nutpick. "You ought to have it out." "I know. I will. I have 3 teeth missing on this side." "Well, you'd never know it. That made me feel all shaky. Bring me the pinkum, will you?" She poured herself a slug of the vegetable compound and sighed with relief. "That's a wonderful medicine," she said. "The woman who invented it was a saint." Chapter 20. It was a pleasant afternoon. Fremont's Peak was lighted pinkly by the setting sun, and Faye could see it from her window. From over on Castroville Street came the sweet sound of jingling horse bells from an 8-horse grain team down from the ridge. The cook was fighting pots in the kitchen. There was a rubbing sound on the wall and then a gentle tap on the door. "Come in, Cotton Eye," Faye called. The door opened and the crooked little cotton-eyed piano player stood in the entrance, waiting for a sound to tell him where she was. "What is it you want?" Faye asked. He turned to her.
"I don't feel good, Miss Faye. I want to crawl into my bed and not do no playing tonight."
"You were sick 2 nights last week, Cotton Eye. Don't you like your job?"
"I don't feel good."
"Well, all right. But I wish you'd take better care of yourself." Kate said softly, "Let the gong alone for a couple of weeks, Cotton Eye."
"Oh, Miss Kate, I didn't know you was here. I ain't been smoking."
You've been smoking, Kate said.
Yes, Miss Kate. I sure will let it alone. I don't feel good.
He closed the door, and they could hear his hand rubbing along the wall to guide him. Faye said,
He told me he'd stopped.
He hasn't stopped.
Poor thing, said Faye. He doesn't have much to live for.
Kay stood in front of her. You are so sweet, she said. You believe in everybody. Someday, if you don't watch it, or I don't watch for you, someone will steal the roof.
Who'd want to steal from me? Asked Faye.
Kate put her hand on Faye's plump shoulders. Not everyone is as nice as you are. Faye's eyes glistened with tears. She picked up a handkerchief from the chair beside her and wiped her eyes and patted delicately at her nostrils.
You're like my own daughter, Kate, she said.
I'm beginning to believe I am. I never knew my mother. She died when I was small. Faye drew a deep breath and plunged into the subject.
Kate, I don't like you working here.
Why not? Faye shook her head, trying to find the words.
I'm not ashamed. I run a nice house. If I didn't, somebody else might run a bad house. I don't do anybody any harm. I'm not ashamed.
Why should you be? Asked Kate.
But I don't like you working. I just don't like it. You're sort of my daughter. I don't like my daughter working.
Don't be silly, darling, said Kate. I have to, here or somewhere else. I told you I have to have the money.
No, you don't.
Of course I do. Where else could I get it?
You could be my daughter. You could manage the house. You could take care of things for me and not go upstairs. I'm not always well, you know.
I know you're not, poor darling, but I have to have money.
There's plenty for both of us, Kate. I could give you as much as you make and more, and you'd be worth it.
Kate shook her head sadly.
I do love you, she said, and I wish I could do what you want. But you need your little reserve, and I... Well, suppose something should happen to you. No, I must go on working.
Do you know, dear, I have 5 regulars tonight. A jar of shock struck Faye.
I don't want you to work.
I have to, Mother. The word did it. Faye burst into tears, and Kate sat on the arm of her chair and stroked her cheek and wiped her streaming eyes. The outburst sniffled to a close. The dusk was settling deeply on the valley. Kate's face was a glow of lightness under her dark hair. Now you're all right. I'll go and look in on the kitchen and then dress.
Kate, can't you tell your regulars you're sick?
Of course not, Mother.
Kate, it's Wednesday. Probably won't be anybody in after 1 o'clock.
The woodmen of the world are having a do.
Oh, yes. But on Wednesday, the woodman won't be here after 2.
What are you getting at?
Kate, when you close, you tap on my door. I'll have a little surprise for you.
What kind of surprise?
Oh, a secret surprise. Will you ask the cook to come in as you go by the kitchen?
Sounds like a cake surprise.
Now, don't ask questions, darling. It's a surprise.
Kate kissed her. What a dear you are, Mother. When she had closed the door behind her, Kate stood for a moment in the hall. Her fingers caressed her little pointed chin. Her eyes were calm. Then she stretched her arms over her head and strained her body in a luxurious yawn. She ran her hands slowly down her sides from right under her breasts to her hips. Her mouth corners turned up a little, and she moved toward the kitchen. The few regulars drifted in and out, and 2 drummers walked down the line to look them over, but not a single woodman of the world showed up. The girls sat yawning in the parlor until 2 o'clock, waiting. What kept the woodman away was a sad accident. Clarence Monteith had a heart attack right in the middle of the closing ritual and before supper. They laid him out on the carpet and dampened his forehead until the doctor came. Nobody felt like sitting down to the donut supper. After Dr. Weil had arrived and looked Clarence over, the woodman made a stretcher by putting flagpoles through the sleeves of two overcoats. On the way home, Clarence died, and they had to go for Dr. Weil again. And by the time they had made plans for the funeral and written the piece for the Salinas Journal, nobody had any heart for a whorehouse. The next day, when they found out what had happened, the girls all remembered what Ethel had said at 2:10. "My God," Ethel had said, "I never heard it so quiet. No music. Cat's got Kate's tongue. It's like setting up with a corpse." Later, Ethel was impressed with having said it, almost as if she knew. Grace had said, "I wonder what cat's got Kate's tongue. Don't you feel good?" "Kate," I said, "don't you feel good?" Kate started. "Oh, I guess I was thinking of something." "Well, I'm not," said Grace. "I'm sleepy. Why don't we close up? Let's ask Faye if we can lock up. There won't even be a chink in tonight. I'm going to ask Faye." Kate's voice cut in on her. "Let Faye alone. She's not well. We'll close up at 2. "That clock's way wrong," said Ethel. "What's the matter with Faye?" Kate said, "Maybe that's what I was thinking about. Faye's not well. I'm worried to death about her. She won't show it if she can help it." "I thought she was all right," Grace said. Ethel hit the jackpot again. "Well, she don't look good to me. She's got a kind of flush. I noticed it." Kate spoke very softly. "Don't you girls ever let her know I told you. She wouldn't want you to worry. What a dear she is." "Best goddamn house I ever hustled," said Grace. Alice said, "You better not let her hear you talk words like that." "Balls," said Grace. "She knows all the words." "She don't like to hear 'em, not from us." Kate said patiently, "I want to tell you what happened. I was having tea with her late this afternoon, and she fainted dead away. I do wish she'd see a doctor."
"I noticed she had a kind of bright flush," Ethel repeated. "That clock's way wrong, but I forget which way."
Kate said, "You girls go on to bed. I'll lock up." When they were gone, Kate went into a room and put on her pretty new print dress that made her look like a little girl. She brushed and braided her hair and let it hang behind in one thick pigtail tied with a little white bow. She patted her cheeks with Florida water. For a moment she hesitated, and then from the top bureau drawer she took a little gold watch that hung from a fleur-de-lis pin. She wrapped it in one of her fine lawn handkerchiefs and went out of the room. The hall was very dark, but a rim of light showed under Faye's door. Kate tapped softly. Faye called,
"Who is it?"
"It's Kate."
"Don't you come in yet. You wait outside. I'll tell you when."
Kate heard a rustling and a scratching in the room. Then Faye called,
"All right, come in."
The room was decorated. Japanese lanterns with candles in them hung on bamboo sticks at the corners, and red crepe paper twisted in scallops from the center to the corners to give the effect of a tent. On the table with candlesticks around it was a big white cake and a box of chocolates. And beside these, a basket with a magnum of champagne peeking out of crushed ice. Faye wore her best lace dress, and her eyes were shiny with emotion.
"What in the world?" Kate cried.
She closed the door.
"Why, it looks like a party."
"It is a party. It's a party for my dear daughter."
"It's not my birthday,"
Faye said.
"In a way, maybe it is."
"I don't know what you mean,
but I brought you a present."
She laid the folded handkerchief in Faye's lap.
"Open it carefully," she said.
Faye held the watch up.
"Oh, my dear, you crazy child. No, I can't take it."
She opened the face and then picked open the back with her fingernail. It was engraved, "To C, with all my heart, from A." "It was my mother's watch," Kate said softly.